Hi, I'm D. Lanier, and welcome to the Liberated Educator Podcast.
On a side note, and then let's do our next segment, 8 minutes, yep. And I'll set my clock over here. At some point, yep. You got to go and look at what I posted on Twitter.
If you're talking about what you posted earlier this morning, I already saw it. And
oh, where that blog post that fool wrote, and I just annotated that whole. I took a. You should see. I purposely was not going to link.
I saw it
because it'll drive up traffic for him. I'm like, nah, I'm not calling attention, nope. You dumbass. But I am going to get this. Like, who does that?
Hey, yo, welcome to the podcast, The Liberated Educators. The two brothers are ready and able, sit at the table. It's Ken Sheldon, D. Linnea. Yeah, y'all, they doing this. They're purely intellectuals and equity enthusiasts, creating change by shifting the conversation. It's critical to our culture, to our people, to our nation. And for the record, yeah, they talking education. Yeah, they talking about building our own, because we've been patient. A CPT concept, three different segments that's jam-packed with content we all can invest in. Breaking that chain called tradition, the critical conversations on issues, but y'all listen. They ain't talking about it late, y'all just hearing it. So sit back, relax, tune in, and be a part of this. You know how hard it is. They know you want greater. They know you want the liberated educator.
You know, one of the things I talk about in regards to culture is it's either competitive or it's cooperative. And when you create a culture where your primary driver of motivation is based on arbitrary rewards like points and punitive measures that are attached to those points. So in other words, here's a behavior I want you to do and you will be rewarded for this behavior. And if you don't, you will be punished. Like that's not the kind, yep, of environment that's conducive for not only, I mean, look, that's not only is that not a good environment for learning, that's not a healthy environment, period. Think about it in terms of like friendships. Like,
yep.
Okay, here's an example. When I come out to visit you, especially when you and I've spoken at conferences together, how messed up would it be if I'm like, okay, you need to meet me at the coffee shop at 8 a.m. and for every minute that you're late, you have to buy me a cup of coffee. But for every minute that you're early,
tax jar,
no more than five, I'll buy you a cup of coffee.
Yeah, that's what it's not even when they call it like arbitrary reward systems. Like, no, this thing isn't even arbitrary. It's actually abusive.
Exactly. Because
if you did that sort of thing, like, as you said, in real life, and those sort of controls were put on people in regular everyday life, that's actually abusive. So call it for what it is. This is abuse.
It's abusive. And this goes around, correct. And this goes into the whole idea or concept around trauma inducing environments and anxiety inducing environments. Like yep. you're honestly, this is why it's an older book, but it's why I encourage people to read Drive by Dan Pink. You need to understand what motivates people. And I know with you and I, if I'm saying, let's meet at the coffee shop, the motivation, remember, I go back to fear and love. I got mad love for you. You already know that. So for me, it's like, I'm going to get there early because I want to spend as much time with D as I possibly can. And that goes to that same principle applies with education. Look, I understand not all students are going to have a love for every subject matter. That's just reality. But with that being said, if I teach a subject matter that maybe a decent percentage of my students don't really have an affinity for, but they know they need to take the subject matter, then what I want to do is I want to create an environment where their interest in that subject matter is honestly, it's secondary to the fact that they want to hang out with Mr. Shelton.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to be in.
So in other words, you speak it to, yeah, 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 yeah. That connection drives everything.
Correct. And you see that?
It's not the curriculum. It's the connection. No.
It's a connection.
Yeah.
It's a connection.
Yep. Yep.
And that goes that even applies even in a remote environment where, you know, to me, if I were a classroom teacher right now, honestly, with my students, I would be like, look, I'm going to be available at the following days and the following times. And then if any of you need me outside of those times, because we happen to be flexible, you just email me, or I would set up, you know, you have the different calendar things where you can pick a time. I would say pick a time.
Right.
You know, my main goal is to be available and accessible for you. And if you can't make it, then the only information that I would need is what resources and support do you need so that either you can make it or so that you can, be engaged in some type of a learning experience, knowing that I can't control many of the variables that exist because we're not on campus or we're not at school.
Right, right.
You know, again, the default is support mechanism, not some arbitrary punitive measures that, you know, to your point, like real talk, if you really break it down with a lot of the things that exist in schools in general to enforce what I would say really assert compliance and conformity, it's abusive. It just is. Name it for what it is. That's why I keep saying that. You know what? You got to name the problem for what it is before you can solve it. It's abusive. Period.
So in other words, I heard you say connection over compliance.
Connection over compliance.
I remember in college, I actually had a course that was a poli-sci course on power and coercion.
Oh.
And the first book we had to read as a class is we had to read The Godfather as our unpacking of the understanding of the concept of coercion. And the whole thing was about, like, once you start looking at the character and then the relationships between everyone else, it's the respect, quote unquote, that was given was all coercive, 100% right. Coercion. It wasn't actually true respect. It was out of fear.
See, there's that fear and love. That's right.
Yep. So
there was a movie I saw. It might've been a Bronx Tale, which is one of my favorite movies it's in my top 10 where, yeah, I think that was it, where the gangster character in that talks about, you know, you motivated by love, you know, you motivate your guys by love or fear. And I forgot what he said. I'd have to pull it up, but I think he said something to the effect of love. One of the two is more easily sustainable. And I want to say it was fear. But like you just pointed out, you have to have, there are certain dynamics that must be in place for that fear. One is control. The other one is where you are as far as the power hierarchy. And then obviously between the control and the power hierarchy, that's where you get into the whole idea around coercion.
Yep. You think about, like, when we talk about the power of suggestion, right? Like when somebody suggests something, and how you respond to it based on your relationship or connection to them, right? If that connection is actually based on love and affinity, then if you make a recommendation, number one, I trust you, right? I trust your judgment. And because this is an experience that I'm going to get to have with you, then I may say, let's do it. The other side may be because there's actual freedom in this relationship. I can tell you, nah, dog, I just need you to know I don't do that.
Right? I
know you into hang gliding and all that outdoorsy, crazy, adventurous stuff, but I'm going to stay grounded. And because of connection point, also, you'd be like, all right, cool, I got you. Like, we can compromise because we have a relational connection. But if you're an authority, oh, I have to. So what are the consequences if I choose to not participate? Right? Like all of those in the emotional labor, that goes into considering, am I going to dissent or not? And what's at stake if I do? If you have connection, actually there's nothing at stake.
So I found the line. It is, so the character, there's two characters in that. And the question is it better to be loved or feared? And the gangster played by Chaz Palminteri response says, that's a good question. It's nice to be both, but it's very difficult. But if I had my choice, I would rather be feared. Fear lasts longer than love.
That is a deep-seated need and desire for control.
It's Machiavellian.
Yep, it definitely is. Well, then, okay. So let's presume all of that is true, that everything we've discussed is part of our reality in life. and we can bring in, you know, enough of the research to either, you know, support it or to counter some of it. Then I think, okay, how does cultural bias play into that when there are invisible power structures? Sometimes very visible, right? Like police are, they're wearing a badge. There's authority that's given to them. But when there's bias at play, where someone has to make those mental calculations on whether or not they're going to adhere to what someone else is commanding or even suggesting that someone else has to do.
I wonder how many people know the history of, behind invention and implementation of the police in this country.
Gotta go get those runaway slaves.
Correct. Gotta set up those patrols. I don't think people know, or at least I don't think enough people know that that's what started them. Like, you know, if I, okay, so let's piece a puzzle together. Patrols, because we want to pool our resources together rather than me individually having to try to find the folks that I have enslaved that have self-emancipated. And so then instead of me using my resources, I go to others who might have a similar challenge. We pool them together. We hire outside, essentially contract out the patrols, and now you have it. And then now let's start setting up the laws. It's Dr. Kendi. It's racist idea, racist policy leads to racist idea that leads to racist policy. And
perpetuating cycle.
Correct. And so here we have an idea of pooling our resources together. And so they do that. And then the policy is, you know, citizens arrest. And then further to that policy is the Second Amendment.
Yeah. Trigger warning.
Yeah.
Trigger warning.
Yeah.
Yep. It's all right there. But what's real interesting is like we constantly want to disconnect our history and the formation of these different institutions and policies. And in our present tense, say this has nothing to do with that. But if it had nothing to do with that, then why is it still being executed? No pun intended. Sorry for the trigger. Why is it still being executed in the same like fashion? Receiving this, you know, resulting in the same things.
Same book, different story.
Right. And then why are there other laws that are put in place to protect those that, quote unquote, make mistakes as law-abiding citizens?
Correct.
In, quote, just operating within their rights as citizens.
I, not only am I in agreement with you, I think that there are certain professions that there is literally no room for error. I'm going to give you an example. You don't see anyone saying, well, we have a few bad Apple pilots, but most of them are good.
Oh, right. No, of course not.
Okay. So yeah, you can't.
What's wild is like, so I did advanced military training for Air Force. And those instructors would bark at you so loudly and so hard over the most minuscule of things, but they would make the connection like, you make that mistake, someone's dead.
Right.
Imagine that, you know, so they put you in a scenario where it's like, why are you blowing up this whole thing of I put my tray down wrong in the mess hall? And they're like, you put down something wrong in a wartime situation, people die. That's why. And like the shock effect of making sure that you understood the gravity of making sure that you paid attention to all the details someone dies.
Correct.
But here's a question. and I've been dealing with this. I don't have the answer to it. I'm curious your opinion. And that is, like, if you have someone who has been completely conditioned and indoctrinated, if you will, in racism, right? It is part of the fabric of their belief system. Can you out-train that?
In other words, can you unlearn it?
Can you take a police candidate who has a racist upbringing? Sometimes it's overt. Sometimes it's a ton of implicit bias that's deeply ingrained, right? So that they really do have instinctive reactions to people of color. Can you out-train that?
So I think you can, but I think, you know, as I always say, it starts off with the acknowledgement and the awareness. You have to acknowledge that there is a potential for that. Then you have to develop an awareness that it exists. And then you can name a problem for what it is. And then now you can address it. So I do think so. You mean, you know, I've seen plenty of stories, lots of stories where, you know, you've got Daryl Davis, who has, I don't know what the number was, but in his work and conversations has converted, man, I don't remember, but it's quite a few former KKK members. And keep in mind, these are folks that have, they were, to your point, this is what was normalized for them. This is what they not only believed in, but it was not just, this is what I believe in. It was part of their lived experience. And then there was the one, it's a recent movie with the two folks there in Durham, North Carolina. I don't remember their names, but, you know, same thing. So yeah, I believe, again, I think the key is you have to name the problem for what it is. You have to be in a position to acknowledge that it is a problem and develop an awareness mm-hmm. around what the cause of the problem is. And then you can begin the process of unlearning. So I do think it is possible.
I'm just wondering if our police forces, which, by the way, I think there's something problematic in that language in and of itself. I wonder if they're willing to make that investment, recognizing that it's not a one size fits all. Right? I mean, you're talking about like creating custom training for those who are on different levels of the gradient scale of having deep levels of implicit bias.
I mean, we all have deep levels.
And or do you just disqualify certain people? Like, you know what?
Yes. Yes, you do. Yes. Dude,
we can't hire you.
Doesn't the military do that? Fire department does. There are certain things that disqualify you. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You have to have, you have to have a minimum standard. Now, of course, that's subjective because what constitutes minimum, mm-hmm. but yeah, there right. should be some things that that disqualify you. Yes. You know, mm-hmm. you have those in place for educators. You have those in place for so many different things. And when you're talking about, you know, when you're talking about public service, yes, there should be a minimum. And in fact, not only should there be a minimum, I remember seeing the statistic that is aligned with what we're talking about. Here in the state of California, you only go through roughly about, and I don't remember the exact number, but I want to say it was roughly about 800 hours of training to become a police officer. And think about it, and to become a barber, it's 1,500 hours to get your license. Mm. So yeah, there should be a minimum threshold, and there should be higher degrees of accountability as far as a vetting process for you to become any of those things. Anytime you're doing something that is in service to the public, that mm-hmm. service should also come with the right degrees of protection and then the right degrees of accountability within that. When you don't have that is when you start to get, the system itself becomes not only disjointed, but you just get cracks in it. And unless you fill those cracks, guess what? They become bigger and deeper.
Right. Right. So in other words, we're talking about anti-bias training of some sort, and it being something that's not only absolutely pertinent and necessary and prerequisite, but it being diagnostic for what needs to be next for individuals who are applying for certain careers. So obviously the police, and then you mentioned educators. Like, if you have somebody who has deeply ingrained belief systems that are negative towards people of color, and then you are entrusting this individual to be in front of children of color for 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, 180 or so days a year, over the course of a minimum of 12 years. Dang.
Yeah. Well, there's some numbers for you, man. Yeah.
It really does make me ask that question, you know, again and again, like, can you out-train the things that have been ingrained? Right.
I go back to my statement. I think you can, but it requires certain pieces to be in place to be able to do it. And yeah. But I do think you can. I think people can change. The key is, do they want to change?
I agree with that.
And the key is, do they want to change? And as I shared, what is in place to recognize what change is needed in the first place?
Right.
Yeah, I strongly believe that.
Yeah. Cause what's interesting is it seems like we constantly, always as a society, only deal with symptoms. Like, we only deal with symptoms. And I'm even thinking about this from an empathetic and compassionate standpoint for teachers, right? Like, how do you help teachers to not make the major mistakes that they can find themselves making, right? Mm-hmm. How do we help them to not step on those landmines? Now, to be completely honest, my primary even motivation, even thinking about the teachers in that regard, isn't primarily towards them. It's primarily towards the children. It's like, because your mistakes are actually detrimental to the future, maybe to the present of this child. And so, whatever it takes to help you, let's give you those supports that are needed. But at the same time, honest and real, like, these are working individuals within an industry in which I love and have a lot of connection to. And so I know that if I'm speaking to another educator, if I'm speaking to another classroom teacher or a former classroom teacher, if I'm speaking to an administrator, we can dive deep immediately because we have a context and shared understanding right. of what this sort of work is. But in that camaraderie as colleagues, so to speak, there's still also this caution of, you realize you are responsible for nurturing the minds of these children. And that includes the ways in which you can punish Black and brown kids and the ways in which you can further push the stereotypes and tropes and racism in white students. And so if we don't help you, you're going to create all kinds of damage. But here's the thing. I think that, and correct me if you think differently, but I think that the main motivation for a teacher to say, okay, I'm willing to go through this process and to become more self-aware and to grow in my thoughts and actions and to be a better person, let's just call it as simply as that, is because I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to be the next person flamed on social media. I don't want to be suspended from my district for making some super mistake. I don't want to be exposed by the media. I don't want any of those bad things to happen to me. So I better be better. So help me be better. I hate it to be a motivation for many that is their entryway to getting help. But I'm like, hey, if that's what it takes, all right, let's surround you with whatever supports and all the help that you need so that, quote, you don't get in trouble.
Well, here's the thing. There's usually only one of two things that are going to motivate you, love or fear. One of those. There might be some, there, of course, there's nuance. It's not necessarily in absolutes, but either you love your job and you're going to be motivated to do it, or you fear consequences or potential consequences and you're going to be motivated to do something. Now, right. Of course, we can talk about it perhaps later, ask you which of those two is the most effective and the most sustainable. But ultimately, those are the two primary drivers for motivation.
Thank you for listening to today's CPT conversation on the Liberated Educator Podcast. On behalf of Ken Shelton and Dee Lanier, we'll see you next week.